Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to a new edition of the Digital Freedom Show. I'm your host, Krishna Nevada, here coming to you live from Harbortown, Detroit, where racial profiling is the order of the day. So it's a very appropriate intro there. We're going to have a really cool show today. Michael Cord is here. He's an attorney activist, and he's going to talk about the Ohio incident with the woman who was in jailed for sending her child to a school in a different district. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the film, The President's House, and some other things. Mr. Cord is going to be with us shortly, but in the meantime, we're just going to sit back and relax and listen to some more of those cool Isley Brothers songs. So my wishes have been heard from my producer, Leslie Gist. Thank you very much, and we'll be back soon. Stay with us. Oh, okay. Hello. I've just been told that Mr. Cord is here, and we're going to move on with the show. Mr. Cord, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and how are you today?
Good, thank you. I got a few questions for you. The Avenging the Ancestors, which I believe is a political interest for you, what's the story behind that name, and is it sort of like designed to, exalt our ancestors in some kind of way? Tell us about that.
Great question. It's ATTAC, A-T-A-C. That's an acronym for Avenging the Ancestors Coalition. I could give you the long version, the short version. Because the show is not on for 3 days straight, I'll give you the short version.
Okay, great.
Back in 2002, there was a news report indicating that the federal officials were going to move the Liberty Bell from where it was in Philadelphia at 5th and Market, about a half block west to 6th and Market. This was announced back in 2002. And we in the black community said, interesting, but not really relevant to black folks. The second thing that was in that 2002 article is that the new site of the Liberty Bell, which would now be 6th and Market, is where America's first White House stood. Once again, we in the black community said, interesting, but not really relevant to us. And then the third thing we found, once again in that 2002 article, is that the new site of the new Liberty Bell Center at 6th and Market, where America's first White House stood, is where George Washington held black men, women, and children in brutal bondage as slaves. And nobody had ever talked about that. I mean, I was born and raised in Philadelphia, went to some of the best schools in Philadelphia, and that was never discussed. So we in the black community, we organized, we protested, we demonstrated, and we decided to call ourselves ATTACK, Avenging the Ancestors Coalition, because it's all about our enslaved ancestors, and somebody needs to fight for them. And when we say avenge, we don't mean revenge. We don't mean putting
right.
white people or anybody else in jail. We mean to avenge as in compensate, as in reparations. And the dictionary definition is to make whole or to make right. So avenging our ancestors, that's what we do. We avenge, make whole the history of our ancestors, and we build a broad-based coalition of Christians and Muslims and old folks and young folks and Republicans and Democrats, truly a broad-based coalition. And as a result, we call ourselves ATTACK, Avenging the Ancestors Coalition. The interesting thing is, historic thing, in fact, is that on December 15, 2010, we made history, because on that date, at noon, at that site, there was the grand opening, the official ribbon cutting of the first, I repeat, the first slavery memorial on federal property in the history of the United States of America.
Wow, that's interesting. Definitely the distinction between the two words, revenge. And since you put it that way, you'll probably get more white support, since it's not a revenge issue.
As a matter of fact, I'm glad you mentioned that, because we've been questioned a number of times about that, so much so that on our website at www.avengingtheancestors.com, www.avengingancestors.com, we actually give a historical and dictionary definition of avenge as opposed to revenge.
Yeah, what I was thinking about, a James Baldwin quote, he said that the reason why the Martin Luther King's nonviolent movement was so attractive to white people is because it didn't threaten property and reputation.
great point.
Yeah. Are we still, since the days in which you were in school and particularly learning about American history up to this point, is there still a sense of whitewash in how we teach American history? Because, as you know, African-American history is American history. Is there still that whole whitewashing issue? Apparently so, if you guys are struggling to get some kind of commemorative recognition for the slaves under George Washington. Are we still whitewashing history?
No doubt about it. In fact, it's funny you even phrase it the way you do, because we wrote an article on, and it's posted on our website. It's called The Black Eye on George Washington's White House, and we talk about the whitewashing of American history. It's interesting because this is timely, this discussion, because we're here in Black History Month, and I love black history, I love African-American history, but I want white America to realize that black history is essentially a part of American history. One cannot go without the other. If it were not for black history, there would be no American history. One quick thing I want to say about that is slavery existed in America from 1619 to 1865. That's 246 years. America is a great country, just like if you were able to have a company and that for 246 years you did not have to pay your employees a single dime, you'd have a great company as well. Well, America is that company. And when you look at it, it's really funny because you look at when Irish Americans do great things, that's American history. When Jewish Americans do great things, that's American history. When Italian, Polish, any others, when they do something, it's American history. But all of a sudden, when black folks do it, it's put off in a little ghetto, celebrated only once a year in February, and that's black history. I like the idea of Black History Month because it highlights what we've done, but it should be taught part and parcel of American history because one cannot exist without the other.
Sure, I agree. I could even go so far as to talk about literature. There's a section, for instance, in Barnes & Noble, African American literature, and then there's American literature with the Tolstoy and the Faulkner, et cetera. So I understand completely what you're saying. There's the issue of the President's House. Why are you so passionate about that?
The President's House is important because as a kid, I was born and raised in Philly. I went to one of the best schools in the country, Masterman, located in Philadelphia. And it's interesting because when I used to go to class trips, specifically to the Liberty Bell, the little white boys and the little white girls, they would be ecstatic, absolutely ecstatic about their history, about George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin. They would not only touch the Liberty Bell, but embrace it. For me, it was no big deal, just a day off of school. Then as I got older and began to do research and went to college and went to law school and studied history, I got angry because I began to find out that George Washington enslaved 316 black men, women, and children looked like me, and specifically did it to 9 of them in Philadelphia, where I was born and raised, at the site of America's first White House. So I was angry, but like all smart people, they tell me, instead of getting mad, I got even. And we began to protest and demonstrate to tell that, because if this is about history and it's supposed to be about history, it's supposed to be about the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That is history. So we say, if you want to talk about George Washington being a great patriot, go ahead and tell that story. If you want to talk about George Washington being a great general, go ahead and tell that story. If you want to talk about George Washington being a great president, go ahead and tell that story. But the question is this: can you be a great human being when you hold 316 other human beings in brutal bondage as slaves? So that's why this is so important to me, because it's a part of American history. It's a part of my history.
Wow, that's a heavy statement, and wow, it's funny because we could spend the rest of the show on that matter alone, because I'm also concerned about how we are writing history, particularly with who's writing history, because there are white historians that are writing on black history. But just for a minute before we get to the rest of some of the very interesting things that you got going on, just touch a little bit on the responsibility of black historians or black teachers, black professors, et cetera, to join coalitions such as your own to help move into the more mainstream idea of history, black history. What's the responsibility?
You know, you and I are having this conversation as if it's a dance almost, as if it was scripted, because everything I wanted to talk about, you're asking me those questions. So I really, really appreciate that. You know, of course, if you're a true historian, if you're a white, Asian, Latino, then you should tell the story of everybody. But I got to tell you, I don't blame white historians for not telling the story of black history as much as I blame black historians, because at least the white historians will talk about their heroes, will talk about the Abe Lincolns, the Thomas Jeffersons, the Ben Franklins, the George Washingtons, because that's them, and they should do that. They should also include other folks, but I understand why they do that. Well, why don't we as black folks take a page out of that book? Our black historians, they always obviously talk about American history, the Washingtons, the Jeffersons, the Franklins, but they need to talk about people like Oney Judge, the teenage girl who escaped the clutches of George Washington and lived forever free. Hercules, one of the greatest cooks in American history, a chef who worked for George Washington and escaped. So it's incumbent upon us. It's just like this. Your mother and father have an obligation to tell you about your grandparents. Your next-door neighbor doesn't have that obligation. Your co-worker doesn't have that obligation. Your mother and father does. Well, that's what it is for black historians and black professors and black teachers. They ought to be putting that story front and center, and that way the next generation will feel it as a matter of course. I'm also a criminal defense attorney, and I sometimes wonder, why is there so much black-on-black crime, especially involving young black men? The answer is simple. They don't know who they are. If they knew who they are, if they knew where they came from, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. It's incumbent upon black historians, black professors, and black teachers to tell them and to tell everybody else.
Sure. Speaking on black-on-black crime, black sociologist Naeem Akbar and Jawanda Kunjufo would say, or would answer that question, to say that black-on-black crime gets a lesser penalty than black on white crime. And as an attorney, I'm sure you see that on a daily basis.
All the time. It's really funny because when you know, most crime is inter-ethnic. In other words, black folks tend to victimize black folks, white folks tend to victimize white folks. but there's certain types of crimes involved in certain groups. I mean, for example, when you flood the poor black community with guns and drugs, mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. there are arguments, you're not going to have a fist fight anymore. You're not going to have a knife right. fight anymore. You're going to have a gunfight. I was doing a radio show earlier today, talked about how I had a case recently where two young black guys were in West Philadelphia, an urban black community in the city, and they sprayed a drug house with SK-47s. SK-47s are more powerful than AK-47s. They're Russian assault military weapons. Where the heck did these two young black guys get SK-47s?
Right. Wow, that's heavy. You know, I want to back up for a minute to get one more question before we move on.
Okay.
Did George Washington ever have indentured servants, or were they all chattel slaves? And if you can, for our audience, make the distinction between indentured and chattel slavery.
In fact, indentured, George Washington had both indentured servants and he had slaves. The indentured servants are people who are contracted to a term of service for a certain period of time. And then after that time has ended, then they get their freedom. In fact, the reason why I say George had both is because some of the folks who were enslaved, there was something in Pennsylvania called the Pennsylvania Gradual Abolition Act. And what that mm-hmm. said is, okay, you're an enslaved person today, then afterward, after a certain period of time, your legal status goes from slave to an indentured servant and then to freedom. So George Washington had first. A slave is a permanent, indentured servant is basically a slave for a temporary period of time.
Yeah, but were those indentured servants, we know Irish came here, as for instance, as indentured servants, were some of his indentured servants black?
Oh, great question. No. There were Irish, there were German, no black. All black, all the blacks, the 316, were chattel, yes.
Yeah, wow. What was the most frustrating part of your mission, whether it's the museum or forming your organization?
Interesting. It was essentially the denial of the National Park Service, the federal agency that deals with these issues. It was the denial of them to be willing to admit the truth. I mean, in fact, one of the federal bureaucrats did concede. He said, hey, Mike, you know, what you guys are saying is true, but the problem is this. To the extent you guys talk about slavery at the site of the Liberty Bell, that's the height of historical hypocrisy. In fact, we found out that there was an area where George Washington kept several of the enslaved Africans known as the slave quarters. So when you go to the Liberty Bell Center today, a mere 5 feet from the main entrance to the new Liberty Bell Center is where the slave quarters stood. So as you enter the heaven of liberty, you literally have to cross the hell of slavery, and that's the height of historical hypocrisy. So the people running the Park Service, the federal officials, they did not want to expose that hypocrisy of slavery and freedom right next door. In fact, not just right next door, but roommates in the same house.
Well, you know, so as I'm listening to you, particularly earlier, you're talking about going to college and learning a lot. For folk like that, such as ourselves who go to college and learn about our history, the truth anyway, it's sort of like a rite of passage, you know, like the bar mitzvah for the Jew, you know. And
absolutely.
Then, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, you hit it right in the head. I mean, this is because it's like the information should be out there for everybody.
Right.
You shouldn't have to go to college to get it. You shouldn't have to go to law school. I mean, we learned the lies about George Washington chopping down the cherry tree, never telling a lie. We learned that in nursery school, in kindergarten, elementary school. But the real story, we don't even get in college and law school and grad school. We have to dig deep for it.
Yeah. The film, The President's House, what inside information can you share with us regarding your involvement?
My involvement is as one of the co-founders of the Avenging the Ancestors Coalition, and there's just so much information about this President's House. In fact, it's interesting because when the idea first got hold of the public's imagination, it was strictly and exclusively the President's House, which means the bricks and mortar of the physical house. But as the African-American activists and historians got involved, we felt that the story of the people who lived there was more important than the house itself. And that's when the story of the 9 enslaved Africans came to life. So for us, it's not just the house. That's why it went from being called the President's House to base the President's House, the story of slavery and freedom in America. So we made it clear that slavery is the essential component. In fact, it's funny because the formal name is the President's House, but our group, we call it the President's House / Slavery Memorial, and we highlight the fact that it's the first slavery memorial in the history of the United States on federal property.
Yeah, so I guess now the site of the Liberty Dale becomes equivalent to the 9/11 memorial site, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. We noticed, we've been to the website, we've checked it out, and you feature some very interesting African-American construction workers on the site of the museum.
Yeah.
Tell us the story behind those images.
And that was a great fight. One of the things that we said is that it's absolutely essential. I mean, no compromise that today's free black sons and daughters of yesterday's enslaved black fathers and mothers must take the lead as carpenters and plumbers and electricians. And for us, that was, a no-brainer. There was no compromising on that. Let me do this. I need to take a break of about a minute to a minute and a half, because I'm actually in transit, and I want to get on a landline, and that'll take me no more than 60 seconds.
Sure. Thank you very much. We'll hold on for you. In the meantime, maybe perhaps we'll go to an Isley Brothers song. This is a very hot discussion between myself and Michael Cord. He's an attorney activist, and he's done some wonderful things trying to uplift the whole African-American reality, and I'm glad to have him on the show today. Let's see if Lovely wants to go to a song. Isley Brothers. Okay, I think Mr. Cord is back with us. And before I go on to ask the question of what you're into now, what's going on with you now, what is your take on the national media's coverage of the whole Darby attack, the Darby boys being attacked?
you know, it's really interesting. When Attack first started moving forward on this project regarding the President's House itself, we got mostly local coverage, and it was pretty favorable. Folks, you know, saw what was going on. Then as we got closer to the finish line, we got regional support. We got regional coverage, statewide coverage, national coverage, even international coverage. I was actually interviewed by an Australian reporter and a Chinese reporter, and, you know, folks found it to be fascinating, historically accurate, and it worked out well. But what was interesting is that once the grand opening of the President's House took place in on December 15 of 2010, for the most part, the coverage was great. I'd say 90%. But then there was an article in the New York Times, and the New York Times critic just blasted it. And he blasted the project not because it was anything historically inaccurate, not because it was physically unattractive. He blasted it because he said it was part of, quote, this identity museum, unquote, concept, where minorities, as he put it, who finally got some political power, would now start creating cathedrals to their own history, ignoring the greatness of America. And, I mean, it was just incredible. And it was so funny because we, Attack, responded with a thoroughly written and prepared document, and we wrote to the New York Times, but, of course, they ignored it, didn't put it out there. But we got it on our website and everywhere else. One final thing I'll say before your follow-up, this guy from the Times who wrote this Attack, he had his facts wrong, he had his history incorrect, and we just exposed all that. And he also exposed, he did, his own racism, because he said, you know, you go all over the country, you see these different ethnic groups doing their own thing, pretty much ignoring their connection to America. That's wrong. That's this identity history, the identity politics, the identity museum thing, and it's always wrong, except, and then he highlighted Swedish/Nordic Museum in Seattle, Washington, and he said, but those guys got it right. Of course, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed folks got it right, but the black folks got it wrong. So all in all, we got great media coverage, all in all.
You know, you're doing a lot. You're very involved, particularly, of course, with your profession, but in the African-American community. What else is going on with Michael Kord?
There's so much going on. I won't bore you with the details, but first and foremost, it was this Attack Avenging the Ancestors Coalition. In addition to that, we started something here in Philadelphia called JTJ, Judging the Judges, where we have the people to monitor what judges do primarily in criminal courtrooms and issue monthly public report cards. In addition, I've been working with a group called the Philadelphia Millions More Movement, a follow-up to Minister Louis Farrakhan's Million Man March. But the big thing that's going on right here, right now, as we speak, is the issue involving a woman by the name of Kelly Williams Bolar. And Kelly Williams Bolar is a black single mother from Ohio who, believe it or not, was sentenced to prison not for killing somebody, not for robbing somebody, not shooting somebody, but simply because she tried to have her children educated in a neighboring school district, and this black single mother college student went to prison because of that. So now my group of cats here in Philadelphia, even though the case took place in Ohio, we're trying to get a nationwide movement to get a pardon for this young mother.
Wow, it sounds like the whole Michael Kord reality is sort of like reinvigorating the whole movement of the NAACP, which of course became a very important legal. So how does your legal training influence your activism? I guess you pretty much touched on that.
You know, it's a great question you pose. When I go to speak to different groups and they will introduce me by reading my bio and the stuff I'm involved in, but then I'll get up and say, well, I appreciate you reading my bio and resume, but the best way to describe me is Nat Turner with a law degree. And I say, when you think about what Nat Turner did, he used the weapons he had at his disposal. But now He doesn't have to use that weaponry. He can use the law. He can fight in jest with the law. So if anybody wanted to pay me the highest compliment and say, hey, that's the guy Mike Corder would like to describe himself as, Matt Turner with the law degree. And you know, it's really funny for me because I'm trying to do a number of things in Philly throughout Pennsylvania, and people often say, hey, Mike, you're doing some great work, and, you know, you need to keep up the good work, and they commend me, and they give me awards and plaques and honorary and all that kind of stuff, and I, you know, I'm kind of embarrassed by it, so I get up and say, you know what, I appreciate the commendations and all that kind of stuff. I said, but I got to be quite honest. Let me give you an analogy of what's going on here. I said, imagine that there are 10 of us soldiers here, and I'm one of the 10 soldiers, and we're in the heat of battle, and the sergeant comes along, and he says, hey, you privates, I need one of you guys to volunteer and take that hill, and if you take that hill, it's a suicide mission, but by taking the hill, you'll help us to win this battle, and we'll ultimately win the war, and you'll be a national hero. Sergeant says, I'm going to turn my back. And when I turn around, whoever steps forward, that's the volunteer hero. Sergeant turns back around. He sees Michael Cord standing forward, and he commends me. He talks about what a great guy I am. But what the sergeant doesn't realize is this. I never stepped forward. The 9 cowards stepped back. And that's
wow.
The history of me here in Philadelphia, because I got to tell you, every black lawyer should do what I'm trying to do. Every
sure.
black minister, every black elected official, every black person who's had the wherewithal to get someplace. And the fact that I'm an attorney today, it's not because I was some great student and got through because I'm some kind of genius. No, I got there because my parents fought in the civil rights movement. My grandparents fought in the civil rights movement. My great-grandparents fought against Jim Crow. My great-great-grandparents fought against peasant labor. My great-great-great-grandparents fought against sharecropping. And the ones before that fought against slavery. So I am here today because of them yesterday. They passed the baton to get me into law school. I have an obligation, an absolute obligation to do what I'm doing. And if I don't, I literally feel like I'm a traitor.
Yeah, you definitely come in the spirit of Cochran and Thurgood Marshall. Tell us a little bit, just back up for a minute before we close, who Nat Turner is for our listeners. You definitely don't have a hatchet in hand.
Yes. Nat Turner is known as this wild-eyed maniac who went around killing white folks, but nothing could be further from the truth. Nat Turner was actually, and many people didn't know this, a preacher. And one night in Virginia, Nat Turner actually believed that he was called upon by God
yeah.
to do God's will. In fact, he was actually out in the field one night, and he was out in the plantation, and he was looking at the trees and the leaves, and here's a man who was not book learned. He didn't, I mean, he could get through, but he wasn't really that literate. But he saw on these leaves, as he said, dripping with blood, hieroglyphics. And in the
yep.
hieroglyphics, there was a message from God telling him that he had to fight injustice any way he could. And the injustice that was before him, that was in his face, was the injustice of slavery. So Nat Turner actually wasn't a man who simply killed for the sake of killing. He was a man who felt that he was doing God's will by fighting against those who was doing the will of the devil. And that's why, and I believe it was in August of 1831, in Southampton, Virginia, in fact, near a place called Jerusalem, an actual town called Jerusalem, Nat Turner, along with several other blacks, did in fact kill some slave owners, but it was done with the intent of freeing black people. And here's a man who was a kid almost. He was only 31 years old. I mean, people think about Nat Turner as some 50, 60-year-old man. He was only 31 years old when he felt the need to answer God's call and to fight against slavery in the only way he could. He used weapons because that's all he had at his disposal. He and his children and great-grandchildren passed the baton to me, and those weapons went from a sword or a knife or a hatchet to a law school book. And that's why I like to call myself Nat Turner with a law degree.
I just think it's ironic how Nat Turner interpreted the Bible. It's just so ironic because on the other side of that, the Bible was used to rationalize and perhaps moralize slavery as well. Jomo Kenyatta says that whites came into Africa, gave us the Bible. We had the land. When we raised our heads out the prayer, they had the land and we had the Bible. That's very interesting. But we have to close, and I want to close on a note of you perhaps promoting upcoming events or protest demonstrations and some contact information.
I appreciate that. The big project, again, right now, there's a number of things going on, but the biggest thing, by the way, there's a lot of police brutality in Philadelphia and working on some projects in connection with that. There's some racism inside the criminal justice courtroom system with court officers, court staffers going into jury deliberation rooms and telling jurors why they should convict these black people. I mean, just outrageous stuff. But the big thing now is to try to save a young black woman, a single mother, a college student, a school teacher who lives in public housing, who in Ohio attempted to get a better education for her 12 and 16-year-old daughter. She sent them to a neighboring school in a neighborhood where her father lived, but the school district charged her with fraud and filing false reports for sending her daughters to those schools. They arrested her. They prosecuted her. They convicted her. They sent her to jail for about 9 or 10 days. As bad as that is, now this woman, Kelly Williams Bolar, is a convicted felon, which means she could be kicked out of college, and she's just a few credits short of graduating. In addition, she lives in public housing. As a convicted felon, she could be kicked out of public housing, and she's an assistant teacher teaching special needs students, and she could be kicked out of that school. That's a horrible situation for a woman with no criminal record simply trying to do the right thing. If folks want more information about that, we have an action alert page on the tax website. So folks can go to www.avengingtheancestors.com. That's www.avengingtheancestors.com and find out what's going on with Kelly Williams Bolar, how they can save her. There's another young sister by the name of Miss Tiana Fury Drummond, a top-notch high school student on her way to college. She was attacked in a racial fight at her predominantly white school, and she was the only one that was charged and convicted, and that conviction could block her from going to law school. We're working on that. There's a white cop in Philly who shot himself and then filed a report saying that a black man shot him. So
wow.
If folks want more information about that, go to our website, www.avengingtheancestors.com, or email us at attack@avengingtheancestors.com, AC@avengingtheancestors.com. And finally, those who might not have the internet, who might not have email, can call us 24/7 at 215-552-8751. 215-552-8751.
Great, great. You know, on that Bolar matter, how does, I mean, is there some connection or does it make you think about the whole Board of Education, Board of Education?
You and I have to do more shows together because they say great minds think alike. You know, in this action alert notice that we put out regarding Kelly Williams Bolar, we pointed out, let me just read this sentence. It says there, therefore, because the prosecution, the verdict, and the sentencing were not just plain unfair and not just plain inequitable, but also were unconstitutional in violation of, and we name a number, but then we include in violation of the 14th Amendment, including the right to equal protection as declared in the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education case. So we specifically point to Brown versus Board of Education, equal access, equal opportunity, equal protection in terms of this educational case here in Ohio with Kelly Williams Bolar in 2011 and then in 1954 with Brown versus Board of Education in Topeka, Kansas. So it all comes together. You know what they say, as things change, the more they remain the same.
Wow, that's I wish we had more time. One more question, because at the same time as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about the whole matter of black laws.
Yes, I'm sorry.
As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about the whole matter of black laws, if you just want to touch on that for a minute.
Yes. You know, it's interesting because when I talk to people as a lawyer, I always say that I am not a lawyer who happens to be a black man. Instead, I'm a black man who happens to be a lawyer. And if more black lawyers looked at themselves as black first, then they would use the law to advance the plight of people who are like them, like black folks. And that's what I do as a lawyer. I use the law to advance the plight of black folks. I was really naive when I was a law student at Ohio State University School of Law. I thought that all black students who went to law school went there to be like Thurgood Marshall. I found out later they went there to get rich, many of them.
Okay. Wow, that's heavy. Michael Core at AvengingTheAncestors.com, at AvengingTheAncestors.com. Thank you for being with us. Well, I really hope you come back to the show because there's so many things that we just didn't have the time to touch on. This is from Nevada.
I appreciate you having me on. Great questions, insightful questions. I love it when I'm on with a host who has done some research before I got on. So you knew everything. Great questions. I appreciate that. And just give me a call back, and I'll be on with you. Thank you very much. Great show. Great job.
Thank you very much. Just the freedom, pushing about it, signing out. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world a better place if you can. Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world a better place if you can. Yeah.